Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
And welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are experiencing more struggles with Skype today, so I'll be talking to you via the phone, so I sound a little bit more distant, but nonetheless, we're on the air today with Christine Franklin. We will be as soon as we've gotten a hold of Christine. But until that happens, I am pleased to report that we are having currently our warmest day of the year out here in Seattle so far. It's 82 degrees, so take that everywhere else, including especially upper Minnesota where Christine lives. I was talking to her earlier today on Facebook, and she was extremely jealous, and I was not gloating or anything because that would be terribly wrong. But at any rate, we're one of the things that has been going on in the news the last couple of days has been kind of a hilarious there's a lot of kerfuffle happening on college campuses right now, and there's kind of an interesting sort of juxtaposition of news stories. One of them
call
was
from
the
unknown
out,
caller. To add this caller to your current call, press 5. To accept.
Oh, hello?
Franklin.
Hey.
Hey.
Okay, we've got... Yeah, we're having struggles with Skype today, so we're doing things by phone.
So
I was just mentioning earlier this week, there was this hilarious story out of a school in Indiana somewhere where there was a Dominican, I guess like a Midwest province Dominican or something. For those that don't know, Dominicans wear white habits. And they always have a big old rosary on their left hip. And the reason for the rosary being on the left hip is because that was traditionally the sword hip. Most people being right-handed, they would reach across and they would keep their sword on their left hip and they would draw their sword. And so Dominicans, being peace-loving folk, wore their rosary, their spiritual sword, on their left hip as a sign of their dependence on God for their defense rather than violence. And so anyway, there was some Dominican guy at some university in Indiana, and he walked in, and he's wearing his white habit, and he's got his rosary. And anyway, the students who are kind of a walking indictment of higher education in America freaked out. Some students at the cafeteria freaked out, and they thought that he was a Ku Klux Klansman.
Yeah.
And that the rosary was some kind of nunchuck weapon. So there was this big kerfuffle, and people flipped out, and then, you know, it was explained to them that, no, he's not a Klansman, he's a Dominican. And the Dominicans took it all in stride. They thought it was hilarious, and so
yeah, they posted some pretty funny stuff since.
There was this meme that was floating around on the web of, you know, on the one side there's a picture of a Dominican and the other side there's a picture of a Klansman, and then it would change, and the Klansman would change to like a like Casper the Friendly Ghost.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
or Ric Flair, whoever that is. He looked like a professional wrestler or something, dressed all in white. But it was like, you know, we are not any of those things. We are Dominicans.
I know. It was hilarious. It was hilarious.
It was magnificent. So there was that going on, that complete ignorance of Catholic culture. And then
hair incident. The hair incident.
What's the hair incident?
African-American girl who started a fight with a white guy who was wearing dreads?
Oh, yeah, because he was appropriating her culture.
Are we that thin-skinned?
And then there was some other story about, tacos or something. Serving tacos at the cafeteria was like appropriating someone's culture. And so there was a big hissy fit about that, and it was like,
and you know what else? This is a true truth. My husband, who's 100% white guy, he had an afro in college because he has real curly hair. I mean,
curly hair.
Yeah. So was he being bad somehow by doing that?
It is,
we can really laugh at the silliness of it, but there is some serious stuff.
Sure. You know? Sure. Well, you know, and there is, I mean, the thing is that, okay. There are times when people make use of really ugly racist stereotypes.
Yeah.
That should be condemned. So, you know, famously, there was a stupid, vile thing that floated around a few years ago. And it was like, you know, It was supposed to make fun of Obamacare. And somebody, you know, came up with some photoshopped thing of Obama, you know, as a witch doctor with a bone in his nose. And it was vile.
Horrible. Yeah.
It was a vile thing to do,
that's
you know.
Horrible.
And so there are places where it's that kind of ugliness happens. And that's unfortunate. That's not the only place where that happens.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you know, going to Taco Bell, not a crime against humanity.
Not at all.
And it's one of those things where you can take anything and sort of run with it.
Yeah.
And you can become hypersensitive. I talk about people who are in need of insensitivity training.
Yeah.
You can make ugly jokes about the Irish. I mean, there was a time, as a general rule, humor that makes fun of people who are down and out.
Yeah.
It's not humor. That's just bullying, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, 100 years ago when the Irish really were down and out in the United States, ugly jokes about the Irish were a form of cruelty. Today, mostly, I mean, if you tell me a joke about the Irish, I'm going to laugh about it. I'm Irish, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm going to laugh about it because I'm not down and out anymore.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of people still, you know, who are down and out, and if you're grinding their face, that's wrong.
Yeah.
There is
an extreme version of that cultural appropriation thing, politically correct thing, you know, so the tip of the iceberg is the young lady feels offended because somebody has ripped off a hairstyle that she feels belongs to her people and not to his people. And, you know, so regardless of where dreadlocks began or who began them, you know, or whether other peoples in other parts of the world, whatever, okay? But I've got one that will curl your beard. Oh, wait, it's already curly. Okay, now this is real. I lived in Guatemala. And at the time that we lived in Guatemala, there were quite a few Christian organizations down there that were helping place orphans for adoption, international adoption. For the most part, international adoptions, U.S., Canada, Europe. Okay,
right.
So UNICEF, I watched the documentary, and UNICEF shut them all down. They shut down all adoptions going out of the country of Guatemala to other nations because it robs those children of their culture. And they said, you have to have only in-country adoptions or we aren't going to give you money. So it was attached to aid. We'll give your poor, struggling country aid if you'll stop allowing international adoptions because you're robbing children of their culture. The problem
wow.
is there are many, many cultures in the world where what is technically termed stranger adoption, okay? I take in a child from a family that is not in any way connected to me. That's a stranger adoption. That's kind of the norm in America. In other cultures, they don't do that. They do not do that. So what happens is the children, the orphans of Guatemala, and we're talking rows and rows of cribs of babies just lying there, mm-hmm. with the barbed wire compounds being run by the government so that they can have UNICEF money, and nobody's ever going to have those babies. And they're being
yeah.
raised in an orphanage, turned loose, and I don't know, 12 to become street criminals and gang members, and, you know,
sure.
because, and then they interviewed the UNICEF guy. And he was with a straight face and with all good conscience said, we can't allow these children to be taken away from their culture. So
yeah.
so no more. Then that's happening in other countries where they have allowed international adoption. They're closing it down because UNICEF has said, you're robbing them of their culture. So let them be orphans and live in an orphanage in Africa or Guatemala or Honduras or whatever,
yeah.
Rather than have a chance, you know, in a family somewhere else. So that's
yeah.
that's the sort of bad end of that whole thing.
Yeah.
Breadbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
That happened. The church was born in a multicultural world. It's no accident that the sign over Jesus' head on the cross was written in Hebrew, Latin, and Greek. And that's always been the position of the church. The church is a gospel that's made for the whole world, and so it's absolutely inevitable that when the gospel goes out into the world, it's going to be misunderstood.
Yeah.
Because it's going to strike different cultures in different ways. Things that are really important to one culture are not going to be important to another culture.
Right.
And so there's going to be all kinds of misunderstandings. So we saw a little taste of that last week when the Dominican was mistaken for a Klansman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a kind of a funny example.
That's kind of a funny example. But,
yeah.
you know, you see the same thing, you know, right now. It's Easter, so we're going through the middle of the book of Acts. And what you see in the book of Acts is you see the church being buffeted from all sides by all kinds of different cultural misunderstandings.
And having to make really big decisions about
and having to figure out how to navigate all that, yeah.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, it begins as, it appears to the apostles' fellow Jews to be a sect within Judaism. And it's you know, tolerated and then not tolerated and then tolerated again back and forth for a while. In Judaism, because there are different views of the gospel even within Judaism. So, you know, the apostles get arrested and beaten up by the Sanhedrin. But then one of the rabbis, a very famous rabbi of the time named Gamaliel, says, hey, you know, cut these guys some slack. If what they're saying is not from God, then it's going to fail. And then later on, you'll see, you know, as the gospel moves out into the Gentile world, people will have different apprehensions of what the apostles are saying. So sometimes the apostles are going to get mistaken for gods.
That's
Paul,
right.
You know, Paul and Barnabas at one point
Mercury
have to say, not gods, right?
Yeah, right, right.
And then, you know, in that same town, shortly after they've both been acclaimed as gods, the same crowd that was ready to offer sacrifice to them in the morning is beating Paul up and stoning him and leaving him for dead. So you get all of this kind of, whipsaw cultural difference, and you find the same thing going on today. People have all kinds of different ways in which they read the gospel because, as the medieval say, that which is received is received according to the mode of the receiver. So if you're into New Age spirituality, you're going to read the gospel according to New Age spirituality. And if you're a Baptist, you're going to read the gospel, you're going to read what the Catholics have to say through Baptist lenses. And if you're an atheist, you'll read it that way. And if you're a feminist, you'll read it that way. So the church has always been dealing with this issue of kind of cross-cultural, trying to communicate to a lot of different people, a lot of different cultures. You've got some experience with that,
yep,
having
sure
been
do.
Like a missionary.
Yeah.
And one of the things that you experienced, you know, since you were there to convert the Catholic heathen, is that missionaries can find themselves being evangelized by the people that they're there to talk to. Talk a little bit about that. Oh, did I lose you? Hello? Is anyone there? Hello? Ethan, are you there?
I'm here. You are there.
Okay, we lost Chris?
Yep.
Okay. Well, then Chris won't talk a little bit about that right now, but we can talk a bit more. So when we're looking at the Book of Acts, you'll see, for example, Paul in one of his letters mentions that he is all things to all, so that he might win some for Christ. Some people have misread that. To hear Paul saying, "I'll tell any lie I need to tell." That's actually a critique that you'll sometimes find directed at Paul. That's not what Paul's saying. What Paul is saying is that he recognizes that that which is received according to the mode of the receiver. And so he was in a particularly good place to be able to speak to a lot of different kinds of people in a lot of different kinds of cultures.
Call from unknown caller. To add this caller to your current call, press 5.
Okay, Chris, do we have you back?
I'm back.
Hi, welcome back.
Hi.
Glad you're here.
Yeah.
Well, it's technical difficulties day here.
Yeah, it's one of those days. It's the snow, I'm telling you, it's the snow. So you wanted to talk about Guatemala.
Yeah, I was going to say, you have an interesting experience because you yourself did mission work, but you also were evangelized by the people that you went to evangelize. That's interesting as well. Talk a little bit about your experience in Guatemala.
Well, I don't know. I guess in one incident, I was evangelized, and that was a Catholic woman who came to a Bible study, a Baptist Bible study. And I had never met Catholics who talked about Jesus and the Bible, you know, like we did. And I'd always been taught that Catholicism wasn't a true form of Christianity. I was taught it was a cult, it was, you know, all that stuff that you've heard. But this woman was very devout lover of Jesus, and I found that confusing because, that's not what I'd been told. I'd been told they needed saving, you know. I think, and that was, you know, maybe one of the little teeny tiny steps on my way. But what I saw was that the evangelicals, as much or more than bringing Christianity, I'm going to say their version of Christianity, evangelical Christianity, were bringing American evangelical culture to a Catholic country. And so we realize, and we saw with our own eyes, that becoming an evangelical was a step up into the middle class. So, you know, grandma and though all those 500 years, you know, or even if they came from Spain, you know, 1,000 years they've been Catholics, but, you know, but now we've entered the middle class, so now it's cool to be evangelical and we can take birth control and we can be divorced and remarried and we can do all this stuff that we couldn't do when we were Catholics, and that's, you know, that's grandma's religion, that's, you know, that old stuff. So we saw that, and it really messed with my paradigm. Because what I saw was American evangelical, very much American, almost like conservative American values and acquisitiveness, you know, all the stuff that we Americans are bad about, you know. I just saw that being transferred to people, and I didn't like it, you know. And it wasn't everybody, certainly wasn't. It was not all the missionaries were like that, but it was definitely going on. But I think the saddest thing that I heard as a missionary, as an evangelical, from our own mission research, was that when people left the Catholic Church to become evangelicals, it lasted probably less than one generation, and then their kids became nothing. They were just secular agnostics. Well, whereas families had been Catholic for, you know, hundreds of years. And that was really disturbing to me, because here I thought we're saving them, you know, we're saving them, getting them saved, you know, but it, for some reason, evangelicalism, it doesn't stick very long over the generations. And so that was kind of mind-blowing. I realized I needed to know more about Catholic, well, not Catholic, really, not the C-word, I needed to know more about Christian history and how evangelization was done before American evangelization was being done. So that was definitely the beginning of my... But I never met a Catholic who witnessed to me, you know, or knocked on my door and said, "Would you like to come to Mass?" or anything right. like that. That was not going on. But I did see barefoot Franciscans walking around, and people venerated them. I don't want to say venerated, but they honored them. And all the hospitals for the poor, the very poor, the place where you could go if you were completely, utterly had nothing, were run by nuns and monks. And Mother Teresa's sisters lived at the dump. And we lived in really nice neighborhoods with gates and, you know, guards and the kind of dogs that will bite someone that comes in who doesn't belong. And I thought, that is really interesting that these nuns live at the dump in the, you know, most dangerous zone in the city. These sisters live there with these people. So a lot of Catholic things totally impressed me, but it wasn't for a couple of years till I was able to ask the really big question, like, is the Catholic Church a real church?
We are talking with Christine Franklin, and we'll be back here on Connecting the Dots right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are doing experimental things here. Hold on just a second.
Hey, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Sure can. Okay. We're good to go.
That is good news.
Oh, you sound so much better, Mark.
Everything is better with Skype. Yes. So yes. We have fixed our technical problems, and now we're coming to you in crystal digital clarity. So
E-L-I-P.
That's good. Yes. So anyway, we've been talking a little bit about the problem that the church faces of its encounter with various cultures. So there's all kinds of examples of this. So I'm told, I don't know how true this is, but just as one example, I was somebody told me once that in Chinese culture, it's sheep that are generally regarded as nasty and unclean. Every culture has got its own things that are nasty and unclean, right?
So the gospel says, you know, I am the good shepherd and you're my sheep. Like what?
It's like, you're calling what a degrading insult, it? Right?
Disgusting, yeah.
Yeah, and so, by the way, we have those things too. I've heard people in the past sort of gloat and say, wow, you know, those Bronze Age Jews, they were primitive savages who thought that pork was unclean. But we've gotten past all of that silliness about clean and unclean foods. And my response is always, how would you like a nice heaping bowl of insect larvae?
Oh, well, that's okay. It's just no monkey brains. No monkey brains.
No monkey brains. And you know, so the reality is that every culture's got its things that are too gross to eat or touch or whatever. And so what God in Scripture does, of course, is He takes that very natural sort of ick response to things, and then associates it with sin. And says, sin is like that. Sin is this thing that defiles you. And then when the gospel arrives, one of the things that Jesus will do is he'll say, it's not about the food. The food was in order so that you would get the idea of what defiles.
Yeah.
But what really defiles, of course, it's not what goes into the stomach. It's what comes out of the heart that's really defiling. Yeah. And so he'll say, all food is clean. It's not about the food. So you can eat whatever you like. So if insect larvae is your thing, knock yourself out, you know.
Bats. Okay, bats would be hard.
Bats. But as the church goes out into various cultures, it's going to have to navigate those cultures. And so it will look at things, and it will engage in what's called acculturation. It will make use of ideas that are current in a culture and say, well, we can, that's a useful image.
Right. We were trained in acculturation in our missionary training.
Absolutely.
We saw a million videos and had lots of talks, and we did exercises and we did projects, and we were trained how to fit in to the new culture that we would be living in.
Right.
Yeah, and it wasn't considered a bad thing. It was considered respectful.
Yeah, right. You learn, you know, you learn what the various protocols are. So, you know, and we have these, we do this. Everybody does this. You don't have to be a Christian.
Do.
So, you know, you learn, for example, when you walk into a Japanese restaurant, you take your shoes off.
Right. Or into my house, Mark.
In
Minnesota, if you can't, you take your shoes off.
Take your shoes off.
Yes.
So, and that's, you know, that's just, so we observe those kinds of sensitivities to culture a lot, and that's fine. And part of what the church has done is it made use of things that were present. Classic examples, you know, in Germanic culture, you had veneration of
trees,
you know. and so, what does Christianized Germanic culture do? Well, they say, you know, trees are nice.
God made trees.
God made trees. Let's have Christmas trees, and we'll the Christmas tree will decorate them with those glass globes that we use these days. Are glass representations of what used to be fruit that you would hang on the tree, and the symbolism was, you know, the fruit of the spirit, the tree of Jesse gives rise to the branch who is the Messiah. And so you get all this tree imagery that gets taken over and used by Christians. What always happens?
Instead of stripping away and bringing, you know, bringing this, you know, Jews from Palestine of Roman era, the, all of their cultures into Christianity and forcing it upon the entire world forever.
Right.
Christianity has adapted and adopted the good thing, many good things, and sure. Christian baptized them basically.
Yeah, right.
They like our wedding rings. My right. wedding ring, it's from pagan Rome.
Right.
But it that's not what it means to me. That's not right. what it means in a Christian mass, you know, of matrimony. It's at all. It's but that's that, you know, you when I was a Protestant child, that was the church was they pointed to the church and said the church assimilates or it's syncretism. Mm. Said the Catholic Church is syncretistic because blah blah blah, but right. you know, but we had a Christmas tree and my mom had a wedding ring and you know, sure. like they didn't think about those things.
Sure. Well, you know, and as I, you know, when people tell me Easter is obviously a pagan feast because it comes from the name Eostra, this pagan goddess. Well, you know,
it doesn't in most other countries it's Pascua.
Right. In most countries, it just means Passover. And yeah. frankly, you know, my next question is always, so what's today? And people say, well, it's Thursday. Ah,
Thursday.
You must worship Thor. Well, now it's just the name of the day, right? And so that's, you know, you can get those. But again, that's one of those things where what you've got going is the church being misunderstood, in this case, by very recent American Protestant fundamentalist culture. That those complaints about Easter are of very recent vintage.
And they're kind of weird because...
And they're, yeah, and they're silly. You know.
Most of the world don't use that word Easter.
Right.
You know, for the same thing we call Easter.
Right.
They call it the Pasch or the Pasqua or whatever.
Right. Which is just Passover.
Yeah.
So you'll get those kinds of things. And becoming familiar with the history of the church can be a great tonic when you start to realize that yeah. A lot of this stuff that you heard when you were growing up was like, yeah, that's...
Bosh.
It was Bosh. Don't worry about it.
It was Bosh.
But there is an issue that you brought up during the break that I think is important to pay attention to. And it is something that the church has struggled with historically. Mm-hmm. Not only Protestants, but also Catholics have struggled with it. Which is, there's a temptation, and this is why the church... is so insistent on not elevating human tradition to the level of sacred tradition, and urges us to really make a distinction between human tradition and sacred tradition. So as the church spreads out, one of the things that it does is it not only adopts culture, but it creates culture. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that European missionaries had a great struggle with was learning to make a distinction between big T tradition, what was really essential to the faith, and small T tradition, what just happens to be human culture. So you'll see pictures, for example, from about a century ago of European missionaries go to some place like the Congo, and you see pictures of the people that they're evangelizing, people who very sensibly wore next to nothing because you're in equatorial Africa and it's incredibly hot. But these guys, European missionaries, would insist you have to wear European clothes. You have to wear, you know, a woolen suit and a stovepipe hat.
And a corset. No!
And a corset. And it's like, you know, it's 120 degrees, you know. And but the insistence was that European culture is Christian culture. So if you're gonna be a Christian, you have to be a European.
Right.
Right, and this is incredibly wrong-headed. The church, in contrast, very often what you'll see, but there's a struggle in the church as well. So you had missionaries who went to China in the 16th century, the Jesuits sort of pioneered this, and they dressed in Chinese garb. Mm-hmm. And there was a big to-do about this. And eventually, you know, they were told, you can't do that. You have to do... And they said, this is... No, you know, I mean, when Paul did his mission work, he basically did, you know, he tried to conform to local custom, whatever the local custom was, because he understood the difference between what was essential to the faith and what was not essential to the faith.
Right.
And a lot of Christians have really struggled with that.
Yeah.
And part of what goes with that is something that you were discussing during the break that I'd like you to talk a little bit about, which is the problem of neocolonialism.
Neocolonialism. Well, basically, colonialism bad. Okay, that's Europeans or colonialism bad. You know, mm-hmm. Go take over someone's country. You know, remake it in your own image, and you know, there's a lot of that. So we like to think that's all over. Yeah.
Oh, well, we're up against the break. But we'll be back right after this. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're with Christine Franklin, and we'll be back in just a jiffy.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Hello, and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here with Christine Franklin. We're talking a little bit about sort of the collision between the gospel and culture, the gospel and the traditions of men. One of the ironies, of course, of the Catholic faith is that after the Catholic faith gets done with its prefatory remarks saying, sacred tradition is sacred tradition, and human tradition is human tradition, and never the twain shall meet. Then, after that distinction is made extremely clear, the church says, hey, you know, human traditions are awesome, too. Go nuts, right?
There's some good ones. Let's hang
There's
on to these.
Right. And so, you know, I was just last week, I was up at Catholic parish, and they just had some big quinceañera. For those of you who are not familiar with Latino culture, so when your daughter turns 15, she basically gets
a wedding.
You bankrupt the family and
bankrupt the family.
Yes, right. And so it's this huge thing, and it's hugely vitally important, and typically centers around the parish. So there's this big, you have a mass, and you celebrate, and you bring in the stretched limo, and everybody's dressed to the nines, and it costs $20,000. And this is a very common tradition in Latino culture. And you know what? None of that is in the slightest part of sacred tradition. It's not, you know, it's not part of the teaching of the church. It's just this thing that
it's a Mexican coming of age.
Yeah, it's just this thing, you know. And it's like Thanksgiving is another example. You know, that's
a secular holiday,
hugely important cultural thing in the United States.
Yeah,
you know, and families will have particular traditions. So it's not Memorial Day weekend family and I are not up in the San Juan Islands at our Hidden Island Redoubt. This is a crucial tradition, and the universe would collapse if the Shays didn't do this thing. You know,
I had a great conversation with now Archbishop Chaput, but at the time he was merely bishop. Mm-hmm. And we sat next to each other at lunch at something, and I know that he's Native American, and he was the bishop of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, I think, at the time. So I asked him, because I was curious, so how does the church decide, so for instance, you're ministering your people among your people who have their traditions, what American Indian stuff can be Catholic, and what American Indian stuff is not Catholic. You know, like, what worship stuff is Catholic? What, you know? Right. I mean, he answered it, of course, very articulately and beautifully. But basically the gist was, the church takes a very long time to put its stamp on a little t. But he said, in the case of the Native American, Indian Americans, they are allowed in their mass, at least they were in his diocese, and it took a long time to get there, to use sagebrush smoke for incense during mass.
Okay.
Now, that might sound like a small thing, but it's not, because it comes from their previously pagan, you know, animistic worship. But these are Christians, these are Catholics, but they're still American Indians. And so they are allowed to bring this thing into their, in their churches, they're allowed to do this. But I wanted to talk about the problem of neo-colonization in a bad sense and not in the church sense, to make people aware. And that is that our government has, and Western nations, and Europe and us, Canada, we have a lot of money that goes to poor countries for aid. And what a lot of Catholics don't know is that that aid is directly tied to the kinds of laws those countries are willing to change in order to get the aid. So, for example, the aid is tied to things like the Guatemalan example that I gave. You can't send children out of the country anymore for adoption. And you need to change your laws to make homosexual behavior legal, to make divorce easy, to make abortion available and birth control available to all the women in your country. And, you know, believe it or not, there are cultures where they don't want that. I had a girlfriend who was a missionary in the Sudan, very dangerous. She eventually got sent home by the bishop because it was too dangerous. But she was there for a long time, a Catholic, and she taught NFP, Natural Family Planning. She was a nurse. And when she came back to America and she was in her parish in California, someone said, oh, the African women must be just so pleased to learn how to avoid children. And she said, are you kidding me? She said, they are so poor. They're very poor. Their children are their greatest treasure. They are thrilled to find out how to know when to get pregnant.
Yeah.
She said the concept of avoiding children is completely foreign.
Yeah.
The idea of aborting a pregnancy, they don't even have words for it.
Yeah.
So our nations are going to these countries who need the money, and we have an obligation to help them, I believe, but they're connecting it with immoral practices.
Right.
And Americans, we need to be aware of this stuff that's going on in the world, because it's our money. It's our tax money. And, that's a kind of colonization. And remember, colonization bad.
Right.
That's a kind of colonization, is forcing values that are, I guess, quote, our but not my values upon peoples who don't even have words in their vocabulary for those activities, and saying, you must do this or no money, no food, no drugs.
The program has been described by P.J. O'Rourke as just enough of me, way too much of you.
Way too many of you. Yeah. Brown people, white people good, brown people bad. And if you said that to them, they'd be horrified. But it's like, you'd let people go hungry because they don't want your birth control, because they want their children. They don't want abortion in their country. They think that's bad, and that's forcing the extortion. Yeah, it is. Yeah. And that is a social justice issue, and that is a pro-life issue.
Yeah.
Okay, off soapbox, off. She's down. I have stepped off.
Well done.
People need to know that. We need to know that we are not the only country in the world. You know, sometimes I get so sick of all this stuff. It's like,
Well, it is. It's part of the data. C.S. Lewis remarked of England, but I think it's even more true of the United States. He said that he was a converted pagan living among apostate Puritans. That's very true of American culture as well.
America
has always been a Puritan culture.
Yes,
always. And as it de-Christianizes, it doesn't cease to be Puritan. It just ceases to be Christian. And so it still has this overwhelming sense of mission.
And privilege.
Oh, yeah. And
electedness.
Chesterton once... Oh, absolutely.
Electedness.
Chesterton once remarked that America was a nation with the soul of a church. To become French, all you had to do was be born in France. And in a certain sense, it's very difficult to become French if you're not from France or England. But to become American, all you do is you just sign off on a creed. And then you're an American. And that's really all Americans have in common. And so we have this creedal sense. We have this intense sense of mission. And so we go on. There's the old joke about, did you hear about the Jehovah Witness who became an atheist? He goes around knocking on doors, but doesn't know why.
Doesn't know why.
and that's kind of our position. So we're very convinced that God has called us to export democratic capitalism wherever we go. That's just a given. And with that goes, everybody needs to abort and contracept like us, because that's who we are, and therefore everybody should be like us, because, we are the greatest nation in the world.
That's why you people are poor.
Right, because you're not like us.
And we're not. That's why you people over there,
so there was this intense belief. There was this huge intense belief, 15 years ago, that all we had to do was just roll the tanks into Iraq and knock down whatever was there, and we could set up a democratic capitalist state on this barren soil of Iraq. And and we're still like the people that were convinced of this deeply missionary impulse still have not abandoned the faith. They still are convinced that we can make this work if we just hold our jaw right and do the right things, And in the meantime, of course, I mean, the whole place is, once we destroyed what was there, what came in, now we got ISIS, and it's like...
So what, so here's the thing. It's like, I grew up believing everybody should be, every nation should be democratic. That's fair. Right. But... Mm-hmm. There's some places where they don't want that.
They don't want it, or
they don't want it.
They're just not ready for it. But all of these are theological beliefs,
Yeah. Okay.
And
we don't realize that.
So we have we continue to have a theology, And meanwhile, the church is looks at things like this and practicing prudence. Looks first of all at her own tradition and says, "Is this a just war?" Well,
we're done.
Two popes and all the bishops of the world said no. Hey, I want to thank you so much, Chris Franklin, for being on the show today.
I
want to thank our heroic producer, Ethan Bolin, for fixing our technology. And I want to thank all of you for listening to Connecting the Dots. We'll be back.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.